Well, first of all, I'd like to welcome you all. Most of you I don't know. I think almost everybody I don't know. So still, a way of connecting with all of you. At this moment, still strangers, but maybe that can change in the course of the next hour. And first of all, I'd like to express the appreciation for the invitation to offer something tonight. As it's customary in our tradition, we always have to be invited. We can't just go and say, I'll give a talk tonight and get cracking. That's not our style, but there's an invitation made, and then there's also a sense of openness, at least in my mind, then, okay, if that's the case, then I can speak a few words and share something out of my monastic life. In fact, this particular place here, Chitos, is very significant for me, just to go a little bit into my story, because here I became a monk in 1986. So it's a long time ago. Some of you might not have been born yet. Huh? No, it's not that young. And even before that, before I became a monk, I was connected with this place actually from the first year. I visited here as a layperson. In 1979, just missed Lumpur Cha, camped out in the field where all your cars are parked. I put my tent up. And then a year later, I was still living in Germany at the time. A year later, I moved here. I emigrated from Germany to England, and with the idea to settle here close to the monastery. My intention was to be close to the place, to come frequently, just like you, you know, every weekend, maybe spend long weekends here when time and circumstances would allow. And so I did that. And then, of course, as always, things do change. Intentions change. Life situations change. And then a few years later, I found myself, ooh, now you really have to actually walk your talk. Because I was always telling everyone how important this was for me, and then, of course, because of certain, I was in a relationship at the time, because of these life circumstances, it was not possible just to back out. But when that ended, then the door of a monastery was wide open, and so then I started actually at Amaravati in '84 when Amaravati opened as an Anagarika, and then my last half year as an Anagarika. 2 years I did as an Anagarika in those days. We didn't have the official novice, the Saman era. Then the last half year spent here to prepare for the Upasampada, for the Bhikkhu ordination, which then happened in the summer of '86. And so when I speak like that, I realize this is a bit like my spiritual home, I would say. Even though I haven't lived here actually ever since. Only once I came back for 2 months, maybe 15 years ago, and giving Ajahn Sucitto a break when he wanted to have a bit of a time out. But otherwise, I've actually never lived here, only occasionally visited for elders' meetings. Of course, as an abbot, then you're automatically an elder. You're supposed to attend elders' meetings, which happen twice annually in either Amaravati or Harnam or here in Chithurst. And so in this way, I was never really, actually never really settled here. And also same applies to Amaravati, since I actually left England in 1993. And so this year when, I should also say, my giving back the duties. I don't like the word retirement for habits because it sounds rather strange. But giving back the duties of the leader or the senior monk of monastery, that happened about a year ago. And then my intention was to give my successor a bit of space and also time to settle into his new role, because it's quite a significant step. And of course, as you know, Ajahn Ahimsako is in a similar position right here, right now, taking on the big ship of Chitta Viveka, It's a much bigger ship than the one in the mountains in Switzerland, which is a much smaller monastery. But nevertheless, it's good if then the new person can really step into that new role, the new responsibilities and duties and so forth, without having the old guy breathing down his neck all the time. So that I wanted to avoid, and I realized he was very happy when I told him that I was going away for at least 1 year before returning. Also, I would do it in a similar style than other senior monks have done, Ajahn Sujito, of course, here, and Ajahn Pasano and Abegiri in California. And I feel very much connected with the environment in German part of Switzerland. That's my native language also, so all the teaching and so forth happens there, or most of it, not all of it, happens in German. And so I want to return and then live as we say, emeritus. I'm not an elder anymore, I'm an emeritus. Don't tell me what the difference is. But this is the kind of terms we use to make distinctions between the different roles we play in our community. And so when I left Switzerland beginning of November last year, of course I had to think about what you do, where do you go now? You know, the world is wide open. The world could be my oyster, so to speak. And in some strange way it was, actually, because I did quite a bit of travel. I wanted to also, this is part of the privilege of not being in duty, bound down by duties and responsibility, that you can actually then spend time in other monasteries where I never had the chance to. For example, I spent a month in Portugal to start off with, and then spent the winter retreat, half a year actually, in the Italian monastery, and then the Vasa this year in Tisarana Monastery in Ontario in Canada. So quite a little stops in between on the way. So quite a journey there has been. And then, of course, finally I had to decide, well, where do you go for the winter, the coming winter? And well, who decides to go for the winter to Britain, which is fantastic winter weather? And of course, the weather hasn't been my main criteria for making this decision. But I really felt a sense of wanting to reconnect, so to speak, with my roots, my monastic roots, and also with, of course, the extended Sangha. And so that's why I've come here, to spend a couple of weeks here, and then also next week I'm going to be going to Devon and spend the winter retreat at Amaravati. And so this is give you a little bit of background where I'm coming from, ending up here in this seat, in this high seat, which is a little bit unusual for me because this last year I have never been on a high seat. Well, I actually had one in my room in Tisarana, which is going to go into the future Dhamma Hall, which hasn't been built yet. But apart from that, the presentations will happen usually on eye level, so to speak, in Tisarana and also in Italy and in Switzerland. So I've gotten over my intimidation of this high altitude by now, and I want to try to offer something which is of significance for all of us, as Dharma practitioners, as meditators. And of course, as I said, I don't know you, so I don't know the level of your experience, how long you have been immersed in the Dhamma. And I have a hunch that there's a lot of very experienced people here. But also, as always, there are newcomers here as well. And of course, when one wants to address people of a kind of various backgrounds, from various depth of immersion and practice, and what is the best common ground to find so that we can actually all consider and contemplate a theme of Dhamma. And of course, for me, the combining factor, of course, is in very practical terms, is the practice of meditation in its widest sense, but then also the aspiration we all share. And I don't think I make an assumption that we all share the aspiration for truth, the aspiration for awakening, the aspiration to free ourselves from any form of discontent, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, which now we're still bound by, which still happens to us. If maybe not on a daily level, then maybe at least now and then, or when we get very quiet and looking at the more subtler mind streams or heart streams, then we can detect very often, and that's what we do in meditation, the subtle forms, more subtle forms of discontent, of frustration, of disappointment, of yearning, of resisting that what is, what we experience, wanting something else, wanting something different than what we have. Or we're looking in the other direction. But whatever we do, this theme will accompany us when we embark on the path to awakening to truth. And there has been, of course, many different ways of bringing this across, many discourses, many pointers. I like to see the Buddha's teachings more as pointers, which point us in a certain direction, which point us to look at things in a particular way. I don't understand the Buddha to claim that he was, you know, passing on the absolute truth to us and we should believe. Thou shalt believe. I'm telling you the truth, and that would be it. And I think most of us know that this is not Dharma practice. It's not based on belief, on blind belief in particular, but it's based on our own exploration, our own investigation, only through our own insight, through our own understanding, through our deep forms of inquiry can we actually come to understand ourselves. It's another way of putting it. The Buddha's teaching, the Dharma's, to understand ourselves. And it's less so in a maybe an analytical way that we try to analyze, you know, our habit patterns and our particular character traits and so forth, and go back maybe in life to go back to our conditioning, how we grew up, what happened to us in childhood, what were the influences, what did actually have an impact on us. It's not so much that we don't, the Dharma is not so much about psychologizing our investigation, but to go to the source of it, to go to the root of it. And as certainly I've found out that whenever I start to analyze, especially in a particularly unskillful way, then as soon as I have one answer, I've found one answer, then the next question comes up. So maybe it's not so much about desperately trying to find answers to maybe some doubts and uncertainties and questions we have, but asking ourselves questions and then let them resonate within us, not be too quick to answer. Because most of you, I assume, have heard the basic teachings. They know and they have a fundamental understanding, at least in theory, of the Four Noble Truths. You have been exposed to the law. The discourses expose the law of karma, how karma unfolds, how our actions with body, speech and minds lead to certain repercussions and results and so forth, which affects us directly. These kind of things, not to dismiss them, of course, need to be understood first on a theoretical level, but then we need to take it inwardly, we need to take it deeper and find out, well, what is the karma, the action in my own mind, in my own heart, in this very moment. So rather than going in an analytical way, we look directly at the causes and conditions, first of all, the states of mind which arise, and then the causes of conditions which get created from that. The causes and conditions which appear when we're blindly following the impulses, we're both blindly following our thoughts, our imaginings, our fantasies, our feelings of restlessness, of doubt and worry and so forth. That's not a lost game. Huh? We can catch ourselves, especially when we're committed to a type of meditation, which also I assume you're familiar with, which is called vipassana, when we're really looking into clearly, developing the quality of mindfulness or awareness to attend to things rather to get caught up in things, rather to get thrown about by our habit patterns, by the impulses we experience in any given day. And for that, for the vipassana, passana means to see, to look, and V is just a reinforcement, means to look clearly, to look precisely, we could also say. So when we practice vipassana meditation, we're looking precisely and clearly into the intricacies of our mental functioning. What is taking place? We're stepping back, so to speak, first of all. We need to be able to step back. Otherwise, if we're in the whirlpool of our emotions, our feelings, our thoughts, then it's very difficult to get a perspective on what's actually happening. Usually then, an insight can happen maybe afterwards, much later afterwards, which is not to be dismissed, but it doesn't have the kind of depth and profundity of an insight which and an understanding which arises in the midst of our investigation, when our mind becomes very quiet and becomes very still. So first of all, we're leading the heart, we're leading the mind to a sense of stillness. It's really a very necessary prerequisite to be able to inquire and investigate with panya, with wisdom. If the mind isn't still, at least to a certain degree, I don't want to say exactly to what degree, but to a degree, to that degree, that it's good enough to be able to stand back and to be witness, to see and observe and watch the processes which go on in your own inner experience from moment to moment. And then to resist the tendency to add any commentary or sub-commentary on top of it. And we're very quick with that, aren't we? Oh, I don't like this. There's this doubt again. I've been at the prey of doubt for so many years. Will this ever stop? Or will this inner chatter ever stop? This mindless, heedless chatter with no particular significance at all. We all know that. Certainly, I can testify to that. Even after many years of meditation, my mind can still come up with things which absolutely make no sense at all. So if you have that, so we share this. Initially, I thought, I need to get rid of this. I need to get rid of this aimless chatter, of this inner chatterbox. Has to kind of make commentaries to almost everything. And sometimes it doesn't even have to make commentaries, it just kind of churns stuff up, mental stuff, and just arises. And I don't really know where it comes from. And initially I try to come to terms with it and get control over the mind, try to suppress these impulses. Very difficult. Temporarily it's possible, if you're very good at focusing and leading the mind to a deep sense of stillness through, say, breath meditation, anapanasati, and the mind gets very focused, very collected, even unified, then of course the chatter is not there. And I assume many of you have experienced that. But then we get up, put our shoes on, step out the door, and whoops, it's back again, we're back again. we have to acknowledge it's not quite so easy to come to terms with the activities, the objects arising in our mind stream need a little bit more skill so that we're not tormented by them and not always led into the same old patterns and difficulty, in particular the pattern of reactivity, to react towards it. So I remember when I decided, well, it's pointless to argue with that. Huh? And stuff comes, let it come. I don't give it much attention. Even when it comes in meditation, I don't give it much attention. I don't fight with it, I don't wrestle with it, I don't resist it. And rather, if it's in the area, in the domain of meditation towards stillness, towards calm, then simply go back to that. No extra comment. And it's a very simple step, actually almost too simple to be true, isn't it? But it's all what is needed. We don't need to get involved with every little impulse, every little thought, every little feeling state which arises with us. This is absolutely surplus. What we should do more, connect with that in a seeing, that in a knowing also. And that in a knowing, you might have heard one of Lompo Sometos' favorite terms was the one who knows. Lompo Cha also, a teacher from Thailand, Lompo Cha used to be one of his favorite terms to speak about the one who knows. One, who's that? Is it some kind of external agency? Is it some special individual? Is it only for the selected few who are the one who knows, or can be the one who knows? Or is it within reach of each and every one of us? And I would propose that. I would propose it is actually in reach of each and every one of us. We can all access this inner knowing, the one who knows, if we care to attend, if we make conscious to ourselves that this ability is right there. It's not far away. It doesn't need endless years of intensive practice to get in touch with it. Because it's something which is always with us, only very often overlooked by everyday activities, the mental, emotional habits we have. Then we forget. We are very, very forgetful creatures, admittedly. And you might have heard also that the word sati, which is normally translated as mindfulness, as awareness, originally actually comes from sarati. Sarati, the meaning was to remember, to recollect, to remember. But in this context, in the Dharma context, the word sati has more taken on the meaning and importance of awareness, of mindfulness. We have a full mind, fully switched on mind to that what is. And when we have that, when we're fully switched on to that what is, then we also connected with that inner knowing. We know, aha. It's like this, huh? This state of doubt or worry or uncertainty feels like this. There's nothing else necessarily which needs to be added to that. But the way of adding to it, that's the habit, where the habit patterns set in, adding to that which is. Either in forms of resistance, when we don't like it, we don't, of course, like worries, doubts, uncertainties, and so forth. And we do like maybe the more pleasant states of mind, pleasant states of heart. We like joy, we like deep sense of unification in the heart. We like everything which is very pleasing and pleasant to us. And then we start to cling. The mechanisms of clinging arise, which is also, of course, something which the inner knowing, or the one who knows, can be aware of. Where does that lead? Where does it lead when I hang on to something which I find really agreeable, really wonderful, really beautiful? Where does it take me? very quickly, I think we can all witness that that is the very condition that a pleasant state will end. As soon as clinging sets in, that's it, finished, already gone. And we're back to square one. So futile to invest these extra reactions, either through clinging, holding on, or through pushing away. In both directions, don't lead us further on the way to deepening the sense of inner knowing and disengaging from the whole realm of conditioned phenomena. It's another term we very often use. These are conditioned phenomena because they're conditioned in the past. They've been, some of it is part of our personality structure. We have been, of course, conditioned into a certain personality structure by the environment where we grew up with, the particular society, the particular family we grew up with, and with all its accompanying processes of identification. And then on top of that, we've created later on in life, through our own additions and additives, all the complexities, which now ends up with a rather complex personality. At least that's how it can look. It can look that we all have very complex personalities. And to sort out this complex personality seems like an impossible thing. Well, here's the good news. You don't have to sort this out. You don't have to sort out your complex personality. It's not necessary. Because that can be an endless task. But instead, what we can do, we can get to know what the conditioned patterns are by refusing to engage and put new fuel into the fire. And the new fuel is adding our commentaries to it and in forms of either yes, I like, or no, I don't like. So resistance or grasping, holding on. And that's not very difficult to understand. Rationally, of course. Intellectually, it's a no-brainer, one could say. But this, of course, goes deeper than the rational mind. It goes into the very fabric of our personal identity, of who we take ourselves to be. And we have a very strong sense of identity with ourselves, don't we? The Buddha called it Sakyaditi. Which one could also translate, one way of translating this is one of the first things we need to overcome in order to enter the stream of awakening, or the first level of awakening, is to penetrate this Sakyaditi. Sakya actually means groups, and Ditti is a kind of view, the wrong view of holding groups. And what groups? These are the groups which actually is very nicely in Theravada, we have these nice categories. The five groups which make up our personality or our person. One is the body, then we have the feelings, we have memory and perceptions, we have mental formations or thinking, intention and so forth, and then we have consciousness, the different forms of consciousness connected with our senses. And this is very neat and easy, again, to understand. Cognitively, again, it's not a big, huge brain exercise, but it's helpful, isn't it, to get things a little bit in perspective. This is the realm we operate in. This is where our attachments, our investigations, our investments in a personal identity take place. We take a lot of investment in our physical form, don't we? We realize when things go nicely and smoothly and so forth, and maybe still fairly young in age, and we have never been tormented by sickness, let alone aging, let alone dying on the horizon, and then we don't even notice that it's taking place. But sooner or later, of course, each and every one of us has to face up to the facts of life, that this body is a given thing which is only temporarily here. And then when we get maybe a diagnosis from the doctor that we have a terminal disease, maybe even at a fairly young age, then of course we are really alarmed. The alarm bells ring very loudly. And it becomes apparent, wow, I have really overlooked how strongly invested I am in this physical form, which is just a condition in nature. The body is just a condition in nature with the trees outside or the other plants or the things which we can see when we move around here out in the garden or go into the forest. There we can see, especially at this time of year, we can see the change is taking place. Things are dying. Not completely dying. Thankfully, the trees are not completely dying, but they're kind of shedding their leaves, and it looks like they're dying, isn't it? It looks like it's going to the end. Everything's kind of disintegrating. The leaves are disintegrating. They're getting muddy and brown. It doesn't look very nice. And this is the same fate for this body. It will do actually eventually the same thing. And so this is one area, and it's a very important area, because many teachers actually have emphasized this fore and foremost, to come to terms with the identification and the investment we have with this physical form. There's a lot of strong emotional investment in it. Then the mind, the mental aspects, the feelings and memories, perceptions, and so forth, and the thinking processes. Of course, yes, also, we cannot, of course, pretend they're not there. They're also there, but it's sometimes more difficult to get our finger on and see exactly what the level of identification is we have with our feelings or with our thoughts or with perceptions. Perception is a very tricky thing. We're looking out in the world, and we're listening, we're tasting, we're touching, we're smelling and so forth. And it's just happening normally on automatic pilot, isn't it? If it's unguarded, if sati isn't switched on. But if one looks a bit closely, especially, one notice that the eye sense is always a sense of going out there and search for something, and search for some object to focus on, to take in, and take in the object with the eye sense, and do something with it. It's very difficult to break this habit, to always be on the search to the outside in the look. It's a programmed search, one could even say. We're programmed to search for pleasant things, pleasant experiences, pleasant sights to see, and to the other senses as well in a similar way. It goes like that. So it's actually quite interesting. I haven't mentioned it, but one journey which I did this year was a very unusual journey for a Buddhist monk. I was invited to a desert journey. Just a month ago, I went to the edge of the Sahara Desert in Morocco. And thankfully, the group of people I was with was quite a large group, 20 people. A third of them were Buddhist, and I think all of them had some experience of meditation, and they were really interested to go into the stillness of the desert. So we had a contract that we would keep silence in the course of the day, starting from the morning as soon as we got up till tea time. And then we were two monks. We would retreat to one of the dunes and put up our sleeping equipment and so forth, and our meditation equipment, and the others would have the evening meal and speak and have a few hours where they could exchange notes about the experience of going into the desert. And so the desert is actually offering something which is just the opposite to what you experience now when you go, especially at Christmas time, you go into the shopping malls of Brighton or London or wherever. it offers you nothing, or nothing much, I should say. It's not really nothing, nothing much. There's an incredible sense of space, which opens up very quickly in front of you, even though there are still other people, there are dromedars carrying the gear, there are nomads help us with everything and so forth, and there's the pattern of the landscape, the sand dunes and so forth. But I noticed in particular then in the late afternoon and in the early morning hours when I was being by myself, sitting on one of the dunes, just looking into the distance. This was very inviting to do, simply look into the distance. And there was nothing offered. There was nothing to actually where my sense of seeing could hone in, or the program search for an object could actually hone into. Initially, yes, it would try the first day. But then very quickly, because I noticed there was a very strong resonance with the external environment. And we all know that we resonate with whatever environment we're exposed to, be it when we have a busy shopping mall, and it's in a different way. When we go into the forest, is another way. But when we go into the desert and all you see is just a spacious sky, and maybe just the texture of light changing very gently, very slowly, then your mind adapts to that and resonates with it and becomes very spacious. So I noticed that I actually didn't want to close my eye. Normally I close my eyes when I meditate. I wanted to just sit there and look into this, which let the sense of seeing go into emptiness. And there was nothing to be seen as such. And still, almost without my doing, well, not almost, actually without my doing, it was completely without my doing, there was a resonance. The mind or the heart became very peaceful. Just sitting, looking, and looking at nothing particular. Even not looking for a particular result through this particular way of seeing, of looking. Because when you're looking into a spacious environment, and say an empty screen, what of course can pop up, at least now and then, is what's still left in a sense of objects of the mind. Eh? Occasionally, of course, then from inside a thought may pop up, or a memory, or something, what I had seen during the day, and the perception and so forth. But as the environment was offering such a spacious screen, it could be very quickly detected and released back from where it was coming from. And so you can imagine after a few days of this, one's whole inner heart-mind experience adapts to that more and more. One feels more and more spacious, more and more tuned in to that spaciousness, that emptiness, but also to that when it becomes increasingly aware of what arises within the emptiness, what still wants to draw my attention to it. And my experience was it doesn't seem to be quite so demanding as it is, say, in the normal run of things. It was, you know, very much something which was in a very natural way released. And the inner knowing, the one who knows, or the heart which knew, or, you know, what arises in any given moment, was without my doing established. I was sitting there knowing. This is the space, this is the emptiness, and these are the objects. And there's the knowing. There's the knowing of moving into the space, into the emptiness, and there's the knowing also when the objects arise. And there's the knowing when maybe a tendency to cling, to grasp after an object sets in, or when this tendency is absent, when it doesn't set in, when I can just abide with this spacious inner knowing and enjoy the heart in, one could say, in its natural state. Because our heart, as many indications say in the scriptures, is in its natural, the natural state of the heart is spacious, is as clear, is clarity there. Just like the clarity of a morning sky in the desert, I found that a very good analogy. It's this immense clarity coming up after darkness of the night, suddenly this immense clarity emerges. Wonderful analogy to the clarity of the nature of our mind. And the expanse of that is endless. The expansiveness of that kind of mind has no limits, it's boundless. And these were kind of sentiments arising. And this, don't get me wrong, this is not a claim about a particular achievement, a particular realization or level of awakening. These are just natural phenomena. In this particular environment, there was, one could almost say, an invitation to attend to things like that. To see there's spaciousness, there's the emptiness, and the resonance inside, and then there's that which can be known within that. The inner knowing knows this clarity, spaciousness, and all the rest of it. So, of course, we don't have a desert here when we live together in a monastery, or when you go back to your home environments and so forth. You don't have a desert. You don't have that such a spacious environment which almost by default invites you to attend in this particular way. But, of course, that's why it's one of the reasons, I would say, why we meditate, because we'd like to see the difference between that which is conditioned, which is impermanent, which is just a state of heart, a state of mind arising, staying for a while and passing away, and which is more of a permanent nature if we attune to it. And that which is of a more permanent nature is the inner knowing. The inner knowing is always accessible if we don't forget it, if we overcome the tendency to be forgetful, to get carried away by our experiences, then of course that's not the case. So that's our refuge, as we were chanting tonight, and the refuge is the Buddha in the immediacy of the moment, in the here and now. And then of course the timeless element kicks in. We can only know when we are not operating under a certain time scheme, wanting something in the future to happen, even if the future is just the next fraction of a moment. But if we're really with it in this immediacy of attending to things, if you're letting the one who knows be in operation at all times. So, this is just a few words tonight I'd like to offer to you. And so please, that which resonates with you, let it resonate a little bit further. The meditation will be today after the talk. And what doesn't resonate or what was perplexing so often, you can just toss it out and don't worry about it. And that's the best way of listening to Dhamma talks, is just to take that with you where you find you have a resonance with, and the rest. Never mind.